And now, from Washington, the Inside Scoop. All the news the government does not want you to hear. Now, here's your host on the Inside Scoop, Mark Levine.
Good evening, America. Welcome to the Inside Scoop. If you've been reading the papers, you know there's not a lot of happy news in it lately. Yesterday, 144 people were killed in Iraq in suicide bombings over an 18-hour period, including scores of women and children. Last week in Great Britain, eight doctors, Islamic doctors, medical doctors, hatched a plot that involved everything from blowing up a car in front of a nightclub to blowing one up at the airport. When they captured the man who had tried to blow up the bomb, luckily the bombs failed, he literally put fuel on himself and set himself on fire. In Gaza, radical Islamists have taken over. Hamas, of course, has taken over in Gaza. And in the West Bank, the Palestinian Authority is fighting back equally hard. Now, radical Islamic fundamentalism is something that is all around us. It's something we have to deal with. And it should be noted at the very outset that the majority of Muslims, in my view, do not share these tenets. But it is a problem. It is a growing fight in the Muslim community. And to discuss this fight with me, I've invited Mike Lane. He's a Republican strategist, the president of Intellifin Strategies. He and I discuss a number of Democratic-Republican things, since I used to work for the Democrats on the House. But this is an issue where we might have some agreement, we might have some disagreement. The one thing we do want is for you to join in the discussion. It's easy to do. The toll-free number is 888-488-MARK. The local number is right there on your screen. And we'd love for you to call in if you agree or disagree in talking about this very important topic. Mike, welcome again to the Inside Scoop.
Thank you, Mark. It's a pleasure to be back.
I think we can start with places where we agree, which is that there is a huge battle going on for the hearts and minds of Muslims around the world.
Yes, there is. There are, first of all, Islam is a huge religion. There are
hundreds of millions. Probably
right.
More than a billion.
Hundreds of millions, 800 million, a billion, whatever it is, there's a lot of them. It is, as the president described in the aftermath of 9/11, it's one of the world's great religions, but there is certainly a problem with all around the world, not just in the Middle East, not just in Baghdad, not just in Saudi Arabia, but going as far as Indonesia and Pakistan, and now even in London, England, there is a problem with certain people who are getting taken away with radical Islam and essentially not only creating terrorism around the world, but creating a black eye on the religion itself, and you know, what's to become of it?
There's an article that I'd like to cite, if we'll show it right here. It's on my website at radioinsidescoop.com, and it's Tom Friedman wrote this article in the New York Times. And it's a great article, and I urge everyone to go and read the entire article. But he talks about the fact that he was in London, and he heard the news about the suicide bomber. But he writes this movie, this movie of radical Islamic fundamentalism, suicide bombers, is playing in Baghdad, Kabul, Tel Aviv, also in England. And he says this movie gets more confusing every time you watch it. When you watched it on 9/11, it was about America's presence in the heart of Arabia. And when you watched it on July 7th, it was about unemployed and alienated Muslim youth in Britain. In Jordan not long ago, it was about a wedding at a Western hotel. In Morocco recently, it was about an internet cafe. And 2 days ago in Yemen, it was about seven Spanish tourists who were killed when a suicide bomber drove into them at a local tourist site. Wasn't Spain the country that quit Iraq to get its people out of the line of fire? Because these incidents are scattered, Thomas Friedman writes, we're growing numb to just how crazy they are. In the past few years, hundreds of Muslims have committed suicide amid innocent civilians, without making any concrete political demands and without generating any vigorous, sustained condemnation in the Muslim world. I should note that in an article in the Washington Post, which is also should be on the screen, regarding the terrorist attacks in Britain, the spokesman in Scotland for the Muslim Association of Britain, a man by the name of Osama Saeed, said, quote, let us be clear, no one wants to beat these terrorists more than the Muslim community. So there is some condemnation, at least by Western Muslims, mm-hmm. about these acts. But at the same time, Friedman makes a very strong point. He's saying it's all over the world. It's not just about Iraq or Arabia. They're all over the place, and there's no vigorous, sustained condemnation. You agree with his assessment?
I do. In fact, the lack of a vigorous, sustained condemnation is what is perhaps most disturbing. It's not acceptable, but it's understandable. Not understandable.
Explainable.
It's reality that there are a great many Muslims who have been misdirected, miseducated, misinformed, and have adopted an attitude that senseless random terrorism is an answer to something they don't even know what the question is. That's on one hand. The lack of a ringing outrage and outcry on behalf of the mainstream Muslim community worldwide to condemn these and to persuade their fellow Muslims that we are going in the wrong direction and we as a community need to take the leadership to stop this, the lack of that sustained outcry is scary. There are some organizations, such as the one in Scotland you just mentioned.
There's and some Arab American organizations.
And some Arab American organizations. There's a leading one here in America is called the Free Muslim Coalition, I think, or something like that. And they do a good job on that. But they are not big. They are not loud. And the largest organization that represents Arabs in America, the Council on American Islamic Relations, CARE, does not condemn these things. They don't go out of their way. No,
My understanding is they condemn them, but perhaps not in as loud of voice as you
would. You know what? It took them, I think it took them almost a year to condemn 9/11. They just were not out front. It's become clear in recent times, a couple weeks, that they no longer sustain the funding from 700,000 Muslims around America. Where they get their money is in large grants from five or six countries over in the Middle East. They're down to 7,000 members instead of 700,000 members.
They've lost 99% of their membership?
They've lost in excess of 90% of their membership since 9/11.
Because they refuse to condemn it?
You'd have to ask the people who drop out why they're dropping out. But clearly, their lack of vigorous condemnation is hurting them.
Well, it's interesting because I can remember way back in 1982, when Israel was involved, Ariel Sharon, in fact, was a general involved. He had removed Israeli troops from a Palestinian refugee camp, and Lebanese Christians went in there and massacred hundreds of Palestinian civilians. And even though Israel wasn't directly involved, they were indirectly involved. In fact, a commission in Israel found Ariel Sharon at fault for leaving the Maronite Christians in to do the job that they did. But when that happened, in a country that was maybe 3 million at the time, they had hundreds of thousands of people, almost 10% of the population, go out in the streets and march and say, this is not what we're about. Mm-hmm. And in America, and I know you and I disagree on the war in Iraq, but we have seen demonstrations of at least hundreds of thousands, if not millions of Americans over the last few years, condemning what we're doing in Iraq, attacking a country that never attacked us. So at least many Americans are standing firm and saying, we don't agree with what our country is doing. We haven't seen those mass street demonstrations by Muslims condemning these attacks.
Well, and that's disappointing. In one sense, it may be understandable that we don't see it here in America, although I wish we would, because there's probably an incorrect perception that we don't have the problem here in America that they have in Europe. We do have the problem here in America. They just haven't been lucky enough to get us yet. We do have terrorist cells here. They are working on finding ways to strike against America, but they haven't been as successful as they have been in Europe. Still, though, this is a worldwide problem, and the fact that you don't see the outrage by mainstream Muslims in France, you don't see the outrage by mainstream Muslims in Britain, you don't see the outrage by mainstream Muslims even in Middle East countries is, to me, very problematic. Unless and until they start policing their own community, this problem is going to grow.
Christian Amanpour did a wonderful piece on CNN about the war within in Great Britain, and she shows a number of Muslims that are working very hard against these extremist elements in their communities. They're working hard to work with British police, to work with bridging the differences between Christian youth and Muslim youth and so forth. So I think there are people working in relatively small numbers at the grassroots level. One thing I do think that's different between Arab Americans and or Muslim Americans, I should say, though I think that this tends to be more among Arabs than Muslims in, say, Indonesia or Turkey or non-Arab Muslims. But I do think that Arab Americans are less likely than Arabs in Britain and France to fall for these extremist attacks. I'm glad we've captured those that are, but it seems to me that in America, we welcome them. We understand that you can be Jewish or Christian or Muslim or atheist. It's all part of the American family. We are not defined by ethnicity as virtually every other country in the world is. You can come here, you can believe in the American dream, and you can play a part in American life, and we support each other. And I think you'll find that in France, and to a lesser extent, even in Great Britain, the Muslim communities are shunted aside and not accepted as full players in equality, and that leads to some of this resentment.
Well, whether they're shunted aside or whether they choose not to assimilate or whether it's a combination thereof or some third thing or something like that, the fact is they're not mixing and mingling and it's not a melting pot the way the United States has historically been.
You're talking about in Europe.
In Europe, right.
So you agree with my assessment that they're... Arab Americans are a greater part of the American community than Arab Britons or Arab French.
At this point, yes. And I think that has to do for two reasons. Number one, we don't have them in the vast numbers that Europe has. I mean, they had overwhelming immigration of Muslims in Europe, particularly in France and in London, in England. I think the last statistic I saw was not the English population, but in London, almost 40% of the population is Muslim in London city itself.
That can't be.
It is
40%.
It's an astonishing statistic.
That sounds awfully high to me. I'd be willing to believe 10 or 15% or maybe even 20.
It's astonishingly high. What I heard was up to 40. I can't tell you where I'll have to find that and see if we can cite it after a break. I'll do some research on it. Perhaps it'll be the next show before we come up with the answer. But we don't have numbers anywhere approaching that. We don't even have numbers approaching 15% or 10% or something like that. So the footprint that is left is substantially left. Plus the United States, I think, has done a better job in terms of filtering in and out the people who we want to immigrate here to America. And although we're certainly not getting it 100%
right. Is
that
luck or skill? Or both?
Both.
I don't know what skill do we have that they don't have in Great Britain or France?
They haven't made a priority of it. They didn't make a priority of it. They had pretty much an open door policy, whereas we had fairly substantial immigration laws that if you were coming here legally, you had certain hoops you had to jump through, and we were aware of who was coming in and who wasn't. We could keep people out that we didn't want to. So it was... We did a better job than Europe did in terms of selecting the immigrants that we wanted to be here in America. But we did not do a 100% job.
Well,
we still have a lot of bad
guys
here.
September 11th happened from people that were in Florida. Before we go to break, I want to read very briefly from Tom Friedman's article. You can get it in New York Times or on my website at radioinsidescoop.com. He is trying to explain what's going on. And he says two trends are at work here, humiliation and atomization. Humiliation is basically... the Islamic view, which isn't so different from the Christian or the Jewish view, that their religion is the best religion. Most people believe that their own religion is the best religion. But the difference is they can't understand why, even though they believe their religion is the best religion, why others, Christians and Jews, are generally living more prosperously, powerfully, and democratically than those living under Islam. Folks, if you want to join this discussion, we encourage you to call in. We want to hear from you. The toll-free number is 888-488-MARK, 888-488-6275. We'll be right back after this.
History has demonstrated that violence only begets greater violence. And injustice only begets greater injustice. This is not the tradition of our great nation. This is not how we want the United States to be known around the world. We have another tradition that we think ought to prevail. One that is more just and more powerful. There is a better way. If we truly want peace and security, then we must work hard for justice.
If you're concerned that we've become a nation whose national policies are grounded in beliefs that are centered on a line embedded in BS, then don't miss Escape from Orwellian Nation, a talk show in which concerned regular citizens like you and me, not self-serving media spinmeisters, wade through the barrage of newspeak and doublethink that pollutes public discourse today. Big Brother, big business, big media, and the big national parties who collude to keep we the people afraid and in the dark would prefer that you not watch. Show them who's in charge. Tune in to Escape from Orwellian Nation right here on Channel 10.
From Washington, back to the Inside Scoop with Mark Levine.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine, former congressional attorney for the Democrats. My guest is Mike Lane, Republican strategist. And we're talking about an issue of joint Democratic and Republican concern. That is radical Islamic fundamentalism. Now, I've always felt, and I think you may agree with me, that the war on terror is not a particularly good phrase. That we're not really fighting terror. I mean, there's all kinds of terror throughout the globe. Frankly, what's going on in Darfur is one of the most, you know, terroristic, awful things. We're not fighting there. It seems to me that really what we're fighting, to some extent, I think we also have other motivations, is radical Islamic fundamentalism, the kind that leads to extremist terrorist acts. Do you think that's fair?
Well, the problem is there really is no phrase that encompasses it, and the global war on terrorism is one of those phrases that became part of the lexicon and used frequently. What we are fighting is for a world in which people accept each other's right to exist and their right to have their countries and their right to live in peace. And to the extent that we have radical Islamists who wish to deny somebody that right just because they're not part of their sect is that's the kind of attitude we're trying to end.
Okay, but that's all well and good, but I don't think you can argue the Bush administration is focusing so that we all can live in peace and without terror. If it were, they would have done something about Darfur, done something about Liberia, done something about, frankly, some of our allies like Egypt and Saudi Arabia. There are plenty of countries around the world where awful things are happening and we're not doing anything.
Well, yeah, you pick your shots and where you can make your most effective contribution. The administration, you can argue otherwise, but the administration thought that, first of all, terror was never the objective in Iraq until the terrorists moved in. I mean, okay, Saddam may have been a terrorist in the making if he had had the chemical weapons, if he had had the nuclear weapons, et cetera. But the terrorists, as we're fighting them now in Iraq, was not the original vision of what our mission would be there. But still, we're fighting in any place we can. And our fight against terror, although we're perhaps not doing it in Darfur, we are working with other countries, particularly in terms of the banking and cutting off the funding and things like that, worldwide in an effort to cut off the global terror network. Now, we're only having troops so far in Afghanistan and Baghdad, but I'm sure we have special ops teams all over the world that are taking people into custody quietly that we've never heard about. Victories that'll never appear on the front pages of the Times because they're classified, but I'm sure that we're taking into custody people that we've deemed to be bad guys worldwide.
Yes, part of my fear is we've taken into custody innocent people we've deemed to be bad guys. We're not giving them a trial, mm-hmm. And that what that does is that angers people. And in other words, this fight, it would be silly for me to say that radical Islamic fundamentalism didn't exist prior to the war in Iraq. It's simply not true. Obviously,
no, of course it did.
It existed long before.
Of course it did.
And it would have existed if we hadn't gone into Iraq. I don't dispute that. However, it seems to me that our war in Iraq and the way we do the war, not just that we attacked a country that didn't attack us, but the way that we send people abroad to be tortured, including innocent people, the way that we hold people in prison without trial, without even giving them a chance to show whether or not they are indeed bad people, this fans the flames. And it's my fundamental argument that I don't think we can win a war against radical Islamic fundamentalism militarily. I just don't think how many bombs we drop, nuclear weapons we use, it cannot be done through the military. It must be done through the hearts and minds of people, and that when you attack a country that didn't attack us, and when you put people in jail without giving them a trial, and when you torture people that turn out to be innocent, you are taking a small ember and you're pouring a bunch of gasoline and fanning the flames.
The president's view on this, which I frankly support even to today, is that the best way to do this is to change the conditions under which they live. And if you can make people free, give them a voice in their own government, and let them have democratically elected leaders and free countries all over the world, that will be the single most giant step that we can take in terms of reducing the incentive for radical Islamist fundamentalism and terrorism worldwide. Now, you can justly criticize and say, well, we don't seem to be any closer to that in Iraq than we were when we started.
If you're talking about conditions, the conditions in terms of electricity and water and food and schools were better under Saddam Hussein than they are today.
Yes, they were, but the people got to elect their own government. And we are frustrated at the pace of progress that that government is making. I'm sure the Iraqi people are frustrated at the progress that government is making. But nonetheless, it's a democratically elected government. And when they achieve their political reconciliation, hopefully the urge for terror and the need for a massive military footprint will diminish and fade away.
Well, I have a radical suggestion for you.
But they have a long way to go on that.
I have a radical suggestion for you, and it's one that, frankly, I'm a bit surprised that I'm making. But perhaps in the short run, democracy isn't always a good thing. What we see is a people that are increasingly radicalized, in large part from U.S. actions, but from other actions as well, not just U.S. actions. And they're angry. And after all, in the Palestinian territories, the people elected Hamas, at least in Gaza. They have support. And Hamas is radically destroying Gaza and conducting a war against Israel and basically trying to self-destruct. But the people voted for it. In 1933, a good 40% of the Germans elected Adolf Hitler, and then actually the Zentrum, the Catholic Party, provided a little margin of difference to make him chancellor. That was a democratic thing. Now, once he took power, he burned the Reichstag and ended democracy,
right.
But he took power in a fairly democratic way. Let me suggest to you that when you have instability, and you have civil war, and you have a radical, angry people who are going to strike out at anything, may not even understand their motivations. I think Tom Friedman's article is very powerful about the humiliation and about striking out without even having concrete political goals. Maybe giving those people a direct voice to control a government isn't the brightest thing in the short run.
I think the president believes that democracy being the best contributor to world peace is a long-run goal. I think that you can make case after case after case.
I agree in the long run.
In the short run.
I absolutely agree in the long run.
As to what it is. But it's a difficult process for a democracy to get into a war, and it's a very easy process for a dictatorship to get into a war, or to get into conflict, or to get into belligerent behavior, or to acquire illegally weapons of mass destruction. They can do that, and that creates instability, and that creates a problem. So in the short run, I agree with you, there are selected cases where A would be good or B would be good. But in the long run, I think the president's view of democracy and self-designation of government, self-representation, would certainly be an improvement.
But Mike, people smell hypocrisy. The president's view of democracy apparently applies to Iraq, apparently.
Well,
but it doesn't apply to Egypt.
They've had
and it
two
doesn't
elections.
Apply to Saudi Arabia, and it doesn't apply to Jordan, and it doesn't apply to Pakistan. It doesn't apply to a whole host of our allies in the Middle East who are all repressive dictators that we like because I think it was Franklin Delano Roosevelt who said of Somoza, he's a bastard, but he's our bastard, the dictator of Nicaragua.
Right.
We like these people because, let's face it, they're our bastards. There are people that Mubarak of Egypt and the kings of Saudi Arabia And frankly, Jordan is relatively tolerant compared to these others, but all of them are dictators, and all of them support us, and that's why we like them, isn't it?
Well, we certainly like our bastards better than the other guy's bastards. There's no doubt about that. If we have somebody
who's
a strong man...
We're not advocating for overthrow of the Saudi Arabian government.
No, but we are on a daily basis advocating for them to open up their society and become more democratic and let their people participate in their own future and things like that. Our diplomats are over there all the time. Our ambassador is always trying to persuade them, you know, now...
We say it, but it's with a wink and a nod, no, isn't it?
Long run, Saudi...
Yes, we really want you to do better. Now sign these oil contracts.
Long run, Saudi Arabia is going to get itself into trouble by maintaining the monarchy the way they have it. They've struck an ugly, uneasy peace with the Wahhabis in terms of, you know, okay, we'll let you have your radical, fundamental, you know, Islam thing, sect, as long as you let our House of Saud stay in power. There's going to come a time when the Wahhabis are going to be stronger than that, and they're going to have a civil war in Saudi Arabia coming up sometime in the next 30, 50, 100 years. I don't know when, but they'll be much better off in the long run if they start moving towards a democracy now, and we've told them that.
Well, look, I agree with you, Mike.
But we're not going to overthrow them militarily.
The challenge in the Arab world, and I really focus more on the Arab world because Turkey is a functioning Islamic democracy. It is absolute proof that you can have a secular Islamic democracy, I mean, a democracy that where the great majority of people are Muslim, but it doesn't matter. In fact, I'm a firm believer in Turkey becoming part of the European Union, and frankly, I think we should work with them about Kurdistan in the north of Iraq. It's a different issue. But so really we're talking mostly about the Arab world rather than the Muslim world. And it seems that...
Well, no, I think you have Southeast Asia.
Well, Pakistan, certainly. Yes,
Pakistan, Indonesia.
That's true. Well, Indonesia, know. I think, is probably safe. But in any case, well, so there were Pakistani Muslims in Britain. But the heart of the problem, though, it seems to me, is that in the Arab world, they have two choices. Either they support dictators like Saddam Hussein, in some worse, some not as bad, but all fundamental dictators, totalitarian governments, controlling speech and everything. Or they join radical Islamic sects that believe in things like suicide bombing and taking the lives of civilians. And the third way, the democratic way, the idea that you don't have totalitarianism, but you don't have a theocratic, you know, Islamocentric state, that never seems to... There seem to be like three people in a room discussing those things. How do you think the United States can encourage this third way, which seems to me the only real way out of the problems Tom Friedman talks about?
It's a long process. Nothing is going to be accomplished in the next 5 days or 5 months. I think, you know, we're probably looking at a 50 to 100-year process to change those governments. If at all, it can be done.
I'm afraid it's going to be a very long process. Folks, if you want to join this discussion, we encourage you to join in. Whether you agree or disagree with Mike or me, we want to hear from you. 888-488-MARK. We'll be right back after this.
I, George Walker Bush, do solemnly swear that I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States and will, to the best of my ability, preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. So help me God.
Let's impeach the president for life.
My name is David Bell. I am a resident of Virginia's 11th Congressional District, and I ask Representative Tom Davis to initiate or support investigations into violations of the law by President Bush and his administration.
Tom Davis, my name is Jean Reynolds, and I'm one of your constituents. I want you to join immediately with other members of Congress to begin an investigation of the criminal acts that George Bush has committed.
I'm Nick Spengler of Ashland, Virginia, and I would like our troops to come home and Bush to get out of office.
My name is Nancy Maynard. I live in the 11th Congressional District, and this message is for Tom Davis. I'm asking you to please investigate for impeachment.
My name is Bruce Smith. I live in the 11th Congressional District in Woodbridge, Virginia. I want Congressman Davis to support the investigation of President Bush and Vice President Cheney and those that foisted this war on us.
Hello, Congressman Davis. I'm Carrie Plonson from the 11th Congressional District, and I'd like you to take immediate action to investigate George Bush and his offenses in leading this country into a war that's unwarranted and there is no solution for.
We have to impeach. I am just appalled that we would not, quote, waste our time with impeachment. The message to the world has to be that Bush and Cheney are guilty of international war crimes about which we can't do anything. We can do a lot about the crimes committed within the U.S. Constitution.
From Washington, back to the Inside Scoop with Mark Levine.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine. I'm debating Mike Lane on the issue of radical Islamic fundamentalism. Later on, we're going to do a complete about-face and talk about the subpoenas that the Democrats in Congress are issuing to the Bush administration about the U.S. prosecutor scandal. So we'll be back to more Democratic-Republican disagreement in just a minute. But first, I think both Mike and I are concerned about radical Islamic fundamentalism and about the battle that's going on. I think both of us recognize the great majority of world Muslims are not extremists, but it doesn't take that many to do some pretty horrific acts. I want to go back to the website, radioinsidescoop.com, and read from you from Thomas Friedman's article in the New York Times. He writes that General Michael Hayden, the CIA director, recently noted in a speech that during the Cold War, the enemy was easy to find but hard to finish because the Soviet Union was so big and powerful. Intelligence was important back then, but it was overshadowed by the need for sheer firepower. In today's wars against terrorist groups, says General Hayden, it's just the opposite. Our enemy is easy to finish, but hard to find. Today we're looking for individuals or small groups planning suicide bombings, running jihadist websites, sending foreign fighters into Iraq. Friedman goes one further and says the Soviet Union was easy to find and hard to kill, but once it died, that was it. It was gone. Whereas these radical Islamic terrorists have regenerative power. You kill one and others pop up. He writes, of course not all Muslims are terrorists, but it's been widely noted that virtually all suicide terrorists today are Muslims. And Muslims have got to understand that the death cult has taken root in the bosom of their religion, feeding off it like a cancerous tumor. The cancer, Friedman writes, is erasing basic norms of civilization. In Iraq, we've seen suicide bombers blow up funerals and schools. In England, 7 out of the 8 people detained are medical students. Doctors plotting mass murder, could that be? If Muslim leaders don't remove this cancer, and only they can, it will spread, tainting innocent Muslims and poisoning their relations with each other and the world. It's a very, very strong statement.
It's powerful. It is enormously strong.
But I think what Friedman's point is at the end of the day, and this is what I want to see if I can get you to agree on, this is a battle for hearts and minds. The Soviet Union perhaps could be beaten with sheer technology, but no matter what weapons we have, no matter how fancy they are, even if we get much better intelligence, which I support, human intelligence on the ground, at the end of the day, unless we convince people to change their minds, this fight's never going away.
That's absolutely correct. It is not a fight that I don't think over the long term is going to be won on the battlefield. It is a hearts and minds fight, without a doubt. You got my agreement on that.
So since we agree it's a hearts and minds fight,
yes,
isn't the war in Iraq precisely the wrong way to fight this battle?
I don't think so, because you need to do a couple things, one of which is keep the pressure on them so that they have the incentive to work out the political solution and the hearts and minds solution to the problem. If you remove the military presence from the battlefield, they have absolutely zero incentive to do anything other than to declare victory and start exporting that terrorism to other places and do things.
In my view, the very fact that we're on the ground is a continued humiliation, a continued occupation, a continued way for Arabs all over the world, Muslims all over the world, to see us as the aggressor rather as someone trying to help. I'll get back to you in a minute, though. I want to get someone on the phone because I always welcome our listeners on the phone.
Right.
Fawaz from McLean, welcome to the Inside Scoop.
Yeah, hi, how are you?
I'm okay.
Yeah, well, the Muslim world and the Islamic world does not need your help, number one. They don't need to be freed from occupation, okay? When the only reason you're interested in that part of the world is because of the oil. You don't give a dang about any Arab or Muslims and never have been. The only reason why the United States and our government's there is because of the oil and oil only. Muslims are the most peaceful people on this planet. Nobody asked Bush to go and take over Iraq.
So, Wise, let me, and Mike may disagree with all of what you said. I disagree with only half of it. I agree, and Mike won't, but I agree that we are there for oil. I think we are there illegitimately. I think this is a war we never should have fought. I'll agree with you on all of that. But when you say Muslims are the most peaceful people in the world, isn't there a way to legitimately fight and protest against what I consider to be an illegal occupation of Iraq without, I agree it's illegal. I agree with you.
Palestine.
But to do so without suicide bombing.
Why don't you talk about the illegal occupation of Palestine?
Well, I don't consider that to be an illegal occupation.
It is an illegal occupation. My father and mother are refugees, 8 years old and 11 years old. They've never been able to go back to their country. We have their deed on our house and our land. The Israeli Knesset sits on my father's land. What are you talking about? Occupation.
Well, they that's a different issue because
come on, man, don't
the people there are native peoples.
It's wrong. You're wrong. You're absolutely wrong.
But my question is, can you fight your battles without suicide bombings?
What do you mean suicide bombings? Man, is that what you're talking about? What about the cluster bombs used by Israel in 1982?
So you're not going to talk about what's going on in your community. You're only going to talk about... Because I'll agree with you about many things that the United States is doing. But my question is, do you think that there's a problem in the Muslim world, or do you think that it's all legitimate?
No, because it's foreign. When you bring in militaries to any country and the people want to fight, you call them terrorists all of a sudden. Just leave the hell... If we left everybody alone... You know, look at Vietnam. We went in there, we killed 3 million people, now we're doing business with them. Who, you know, why did we kill 3 million people? For what? Why is an American life more important than a Muslim or Vietnamese or any other life? They're not.
See, here's my question for you. Can we agree on things that the United States has done wrong, whether in Iraq and Vietnam and so forth, and also, which I agree with, Mike may not, but also agree with you that there's a problem when you have people in the Islamic world who are going out in Britain and so forth. And I mean, Britain withdrew its troops from Iraq, and yet 8 doctors are trying to blow up people there. I mean, you don't support that, do you?
Excuse me, my friend. Let me tell you one thing, okay? I don't listen to everything. Everything that comes on TV is not what I take in.
You don't believe that happened?
Absolutely. I believe it's all you heard it did that, just like a lot of things that are happening today.
Do you believe September 11th happened?
September 11th happened. Of course, show me one airplane going into the Pentagon. I live in Washington, D.C. I live in this area. Show me one picture of an airplane going into the Pentagon.
So you don't believe that the World Trade Center was brought down by airplanes?
It was brought down by Mossad or somebody. I don't know who
it was. By Mossad. So you believe the Israelis for 9/11?
Absolutely, 100%, because the Islamic world did not want this, and they never wanted this. There's no purpose for us to go after any building in New York and take it down.
Well, let me ask you this, and then I'll give Mike a chance. We've seen many videotapes of people, suicide bombers, who prior to blowing themselves up with nails or so forth in public areas, give detailed videotapes where they say, I'm going to strap this bomb on me and kill these people for this cause. Do you not believe those videos, or do you think all of those are fake as well?
I don't believe in anything that I see on TV. Number one,
really?
I believe that the U.S. government killed 1 million Iraqi children during the oil embargo against Saddam Hussein. That is genocide. Don't worry, you're talking about the little stuff here.
You're just trying to figure out whether there's ever been an Arab suicide bomber, right?
Children died because of the embargo on Iraq. Why is it so... Why do y'all forget?
What I'm just trying to understand is you don't believe there's ever been a Muslim or Arab suicide bomber. Is that right?
Of course there is. Of course there
okay,
is.
Okay, all right.
That is. But you know what? If I live in Gaza, okay, and you put me against the wall and you occupy me and you treat me like a dog, I will become a suicide bomber too. And that's why those people are doing what they're doing, because there's nothing to live for when you're living under occupation and when your country's taken over. Okay, and when you have European Jews and American Jews from all over the world that can go to my father's homeland and become Israeli citizens, whereas me, I'm one of 7 children from my mom and dad. We have our deed in Palestine, Lifta, it's called, mm-hmm. Half a mile above the city of Jerusalem, looking down at the city of Jerusalem.
Where were you born, and sir? May I ask that?
Sorry?
Where were you born?
I was born in a Jordanian refugee camp.
In Jordan?
Yes.
Okay.
I'm not Jordanian. I could never be Jordanian.
But
I am
Jordan
100% Palestinian. My wife is an American. My children are 100% Arab American. And my children will fight for Palestine and the return of the Palestinian people to my country. I'm here as a guest. This is it. I pay my taxes. I'm okay. I'm cool. That's fine. But don't ever anyone think that the Palestinian people will ever forget Palestine?
Are you in sympathy with people who do suicide bombing attacks in America or Great Britain?
What do you mean, suicide? Do you really believe this stuff?
Oh, you don't believe they ever happened? Okay, all right. Okay, I got your position. Mike?
Fawaz, let me ask you a question, if I may. You know, I happen to have been an eyewitness to the attack on the Pentagon, and although there are no videotapes or photos that will satisfy you...
Not me. Millions of people.
Okay.
Millions of people.
All right, I'm going to lay on the table for just a second that I was an eyewitness to that one. Oh. And let's go to New York, where we do have videotapes.
Pentagon. I don't care about New York. I know what New York is. Show me the Pentagon.
But I have a question about New York.
Sure, go ahead.
We have the videotapes. We know exactly what happened in New York. We have the forensic evidence. We know who was on the planes.
Mm-hmm.
We know that they were not poor Palestinian people with no future. These were solid Saudi Arabians who had a future, who had a good life, who decided to do this. Do you think they were justified in what they did and why?
You know, I don't believe in Osama bin Laden. Never have, never will. All I know is he was a CIA agent, and this whole thing is a CIA thing.
So the CIA brought down the Twin Towers?
I don't give a shit, and I don't care. But all I know is that one thing happened, and that is Osama bin Laden is not a Muslim.
Why not?
He is not, because Muslims don't kill innocent people. The Quran talks about human life. It says that if you take one human life away from another human, it doesn't matter if he's Christian or Muslim or Jew, you take away all of humanity. You understand? Muslims don't...
Well, let me ask you this. This is very interesting to me because I agree with you. I mean, I think that Islam does not teach killing innocent people, and yet we see all these suicide bombers who are strapping bombs on them going into places with public, and either you're telling me you don't believe this happens, or... I would love to hear from you where we could agree, where you would condemn these people and say, not just Osama bin Laden,
Absolutely.
But anyone
I could
who would do a suicide
anybody.
Bombing is not a good Muslim. Can we agree on this?
It depends, my friend.
There's a thing
called jihad, which is that jihad, number one jihad, is to raise your family, take care of your wife and children, and sacrifice in this world. The last jihad talks about where you go fight for, like if somebody comes up and takes your home away and you have the right to fight back for it. If somebody aggresses on you, you have the right to fight back. That's a form of jihad. But to go out and just kill somebody for the hell of it, no. The only people that are fighting, if you notice, in this world today are the people that are oppressed, the Chechens, the Palestinians.
Is it fair to kill innocent? You say for the hell of it. Let's assume that the people who are killing innocent people are doing so for some political cause. All right, not just because they enjoy shooting innocents, but they're setting up bombs in London or anywhere else because they have a cause, whatever that cause may be. Is it ever justified to kill innocent women and children? In Iraq, for example, 144 people just died. They were Iraqi, women and children.
Yes.
Was it justified to kill them in a way to fight U.S. occupation, which I don't support either?
Let me ask you something. Do we know who put the bomb there? Well, you and I don't know who did it. There's no justification.
You think the United States government did it? Is that your?
I didn't say that.
Who do you think set the bomb?
I just said nobody. I don't know who set the bomb. God knows who set the bomb. We don't know who sets these bombs and kills innocent people.
Okay.
There's got to be some kind of a
monster.
So
no matter who sets it, let me just get the principle from you. Can you agree with me that in whatever goal that you're setting, whatever you're trying to fight, say you're fighting the occupation of Iraq, that killing innocent women and children purposely, intentionally, that's not the right way to go about it. That's not the Islamic way.
It's not any civilization's way, my friend.
Okay.
Yeah,
well, I'm glad to hear that. And I would hope that that's something that you would share with people of your faith as well.
It's not, because this is the Quran. You kill anybody, you cannot be... to kill a human life, like I told you, in all of the religions, there is forgiveness. You understand? But not to take children, there's...
I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah, I mean, I'm living comfortably here. I thank God every breath I take that I live in this country, okay?
Mike, do you have any further comments?
No, Fawaz, your last comments are somewhat encouraging, but I'm disappointed that you don't accept the evidence as we see it and what the reality of the world is today. And although I'm encouraged that you deeply believe that there should be no killing and no violence, and that Islam ought to be a peaceful religion, and in fact it is, there are some of your fellow Muslims who have been misdirected, misguided, or intentionally hijacked a piece of your religion, and they're using it as a very, very ugly and intentional excuse to wreak mayhem on parts of the world. And I would encourage you and others to speak out loudly against what they are doing, because they're just bad people.
To speak out against the Saudi government, maybe that would help a little bit, because if you topple them, then everything will be okay.
I'm sorry, speak out against the Saudi government, you said?
Yeah, you should speak out more about
that. I actually have spoken out, and I agree with you. I have a lot of problem with the Saudi government in lots of different ways, with treatment of women, for one thing. In fact, after Afghanistan...
Don't go there, my friend. What we have today, democracy and women, the freedom of women, okay? Today's woman's freedom comes from the Islamic world.
You think women are free in the Islamic world?
The women?
You're saying that women are free, equal citizens in the Islamic world?
There's a place for women in the Islamic world. The Prophet Muhammad,
he
married a woman that was a businesswoman. He worked for her.
But you're not arguing that women have free equality in the Muslim world. Political equality.
Oh, it depends.
They can't drive in Saudi Arabia, for example.
You're not from that part of the world. Of course they can drive. They can drive anybody that...
No, it's illegal in Saudi Arabia for women to get driver's
license. I know that it's illegal. I know that.
Oh, so they do it, but it's not legal. Okay, that may be true.
Yeah.
What about education, Fawaz? I mean, there are many places, particularly Afghanistan under the Taliban, where women were barred from getting an education. They were just not allowed to do it.
Taliban were... let me just say this. It doesn't matter what country you're from. The way I was raised is through a very... it wasn't a very strict Islamic family, but I was taught that the first word that came to the Prophet Muhammad through the angel Gabriel was Iqra, which means read in Arabic. So our whole faith is on reading and understanding and opening your minds, and this is... you should seek education wherever it may be. Anybody that does not give the women the right for education is not a Muslim. Women have to have an education. And when you're talking about the a while ago, I heard you talking about your three steps of the Arab world. Well, look at Jordan. Jordan, you know, I travel to Jordan quite frequently, and I don't see no oppression on women there.
I actually think Jordan is one of the freer countries in the Middle East. Fawaz, I want to thank you for spending so much time with us. Thank you for calling in, and I hope you'll call in another time.
Thank you, sir.
That was a very interesting call, Mike, and I think Fawaz well illustrated the complexities of this question. I mean, he's not willing to accept some facts that most people in the world are accepting, including a lot of people in the Arab world, namely that September 11th occurred. It was caused by Osama bin Laden. And yet, while he seemed to even justify suicide bombing at one point, but when I really pressed him on the issue of innocent men, women, and children, mm-hmm. then he backed off, and I was glad to hear what he had to say.
It underscores, I think, the reality, which is that Islam per se is not a cancer, it's not a bad religion, it's not a disease. Islam is a very good thing. But there are some people who in the name of Islam have done some very bad things, and these are misguided, misdirected, misinformed, or just plain bad people. And Osama bin Laden is one of those people who in the name of Islam perpetrated the 9/11 atrocities. And, you know, the point that Friedman makes is that the mainstream Muslim community, the 98% of Muslims worldwide who don't subscribe to this, need to take a more proactive and more forceful role in condemning and excising those bad people from what they're doing.
But let me go further, because it was interesting to me that when I pressed Fawaz on atrocities done by Muslims, he brought up American atrocities, and I'm willing to call them an atrocity. I think Abu Ghraib was an atrocity. Frankly, I think this whole war in Iraq was a serious mistake, if not a war crime. We attacked a country that had never attacked us. He also cited Israel. Now, Arabs are always going to be mad at Israel. They don't like, in fact, that a Jewish state exists in the Middle East. They don't want it to exist. The Palestinians, of course, were offered a state many, many times and constantly refused as long as a Jewish state existed. Although I understand Fawaz has his, you know, personal connection to that. But in terms of the United States' role, It's largely what we're doing in Iraq, I think, that's fanning the flames. After Afghanistan, maybe Fawaz didn't think it justified, but a number of Arab countries actually thought it was justified for us to go and attack the Taliban,
absolutely,
an Islamic country.
Absolutely.
Some of them were quiet. They didn't want to actively support us. But there wasn't this kind of round condemnation. There weren't people. In fact, you still, even to this day, the suicide bombers almost never talk about Afghanistan. They talk about Iraq. Mark, isn't it fair to say the war in Iraq has fanned the flames?
The rest of the countries in the Middle East are not roundly condemning us for what's going on in Iraq. You don't hear...
The people are.
You
the
don't,
people on the streets
you,
are.
You,
the
you
Arab
don't
streets,
hear,
they
you,
are.
You, know, you don't hear any of the governments over there taking... In fact, they wanted Saddam gone. They were happy that Saddam is gone. And, you know, it remains to be seen whether they really want to see the sprouting of democracy there, because once democracy sprouts,
right,
the danger is it's going to spread to their countries. And they don't necessarily want that, although we want that.
I don't disagree with you.
But they're
the
not
Arab
condemning
street,
us.
I'm not talking about the governments. I'm talking about the Arab street. I'm talking about people like Fawaz from McLean, who the first thing he does is he talks about our illegal occupation of Iraq. This is something that is not winning us friends in the Arab world. Here we have troops, and I've talked with those troops, who are working hard trying to build sewers and schools and provide for people, and their efforts are getting blown up. And not only are they not being thanked, they're being hated. We're being hated there because people don't trust our motivations. They say it's all about oil, and it may well be.
You know, right now, in Iraq itself, in the last 3 months, we have made enormous strides in terms of winning the hearts and minds of the populace that's there. The amount of cooperation...
We hear this every 3 months, Mike.
No, this is since General Petraeus took over and started the new strategy of, instead of clear and disappear and let the bad guys come back within 36 hours sometimes, now we're clearing and we're holding, and our troops and the Iraqi troops are living in the neighborhoods with the people. And the amount of intelligence and cooperation we're getting from the indigenous population has expanded dramatically. And this is a good sign. Whether or not we have enough people to make it work countrywide or as far as we need it, we don't know. But the places where we're going in and we're staying there and letting them get to know us and trust us, it is working.
It's too little and it's too late. Congress in January and again in July, in May, I should say, set up very clear benchmarks that the president has got to follow. The president signed this law. He wanted supplemental funding.
Mm-hmm.
And in there are 18 benchmarks. And it's looking like come September, and actually there's a mid-report that's due just around the corner in July, we're not going to meet any of them.
Okay.
Any one of the 18 benchmarks.
All right. Well, a benchmark's a benchmark. It's something that it's a goal. You're going towards it. And
we're not
succeeding. If we're making progress towards it and we don't exactly get on top of the mountain.
We're not even close. We're not even close.
I would disagree, and General Petraeus would disagree.
Well, but the people in your party are increasingly agreeing. Democrats have been against this war a long time. Independents have been against this war for a couple years now. Increasingly, Republicans are against the war. Senator Lugar, Senator Voinovich, not just Senator Hagel, Senator Domenici just came out last week. One after one after one, Olympia Snowe. I think we may get soon the 67 necessary to overrun a president's veto. We're certainly going to get 60 soon to get rid of a filibuster.
Maybe not. It remains to be seen. There are, as you point out, there are very select defections from the Republican caucus on this matter. There may be more. There may not be more. The exact timing of that is unclear,
Mike,
if it happens. But
you're a political strategist.
Yes,
this
I am.
This can't be helping your party.
Do you want the Republican Party to
hang its hat on Iraq?
No. I'll tell you what. I will flat out admit this is hurting us. We don't have the hearts and minds of the American people at this point, without a doubt. But this is so important an issue and so important to the safety and security of the United States and the world that there's just no way that I would ride this one down like the guy in...
Like George Bush is doing.
No, I would ride it down like Tex Ritter in How I Learned to Love the Bomb. You know, it was...
He is definitely riding this down, and I have to tell you,
it's an important issue, Mark. This really, the future of the world depends on success here.
If we had a possibility of success, if we had a chance of success, do we have any hope by occupying Iraq, creating a peaceful democracy where everyone holds hands and the Shia and the Sunni get along and suicide terrorists stop and they all thank the United States of America? Is that really what you expect to see in, I don't know, 20, 30, 50 years after 50,000 American dead, trillions spent. Is that what you really expect is going to happen?
It's probably not going to be as pretty as we like in the short term. However, in the mid and long term, if we can establish a democracy, if we can establish the fact that the Iraqi people are working together, if we can get their government to be functional, which quite frankly is one of the huge problems because their government, even though it's elected, has not been functional.
That's right.
If we can get them to be functional and start addressing and solving some of their problems, such as oil sharing and things like that, that will go a major step towards progress, but they're not going to do it if we pull out in defeat and leave them to go to civil war. It's not going to happen.
I think the government rightly fears
it'll get worse.
That oil sharing is all about oil sharing with oil companies rather than among Shia and Sunni.
No,
and at the end of the day, I think we've got to get out and let the Iraqi people achieve what they can. I wish them well. I wish them luck. We'll give them advice.
But occupation
on the ground won't solve
it. You wish them a civil war is what you wish them.
No,
because if we pull out
what
in
they
defeat,
do, they do. I mean, that's, you know, Iraq and Iran fought a brutal, brutal war in the 1980s. A million people died. That wasn't America's fault.
There are some.
We did make a mess in Iraq. I truly regret it. In fact, I would support an independent Kurdistan in the north so that people who've helped us in Iraq have a place to go to, and I don't mind leaving American troops there.
There are some disasters.
But we're not wanted.
There are some disasters that we can stop and some we can't stop. One of the ones we could have stopped that, you know, even President Clinton admits in retrospect was we could have stopped the disaster in Rwanda. Maybe Darfur now. We could stop or couldn't stop.
I think we could and should.
And we should do that. We can stop the disaster in Iraq. And
I think it's
we should. We should.
The only hope of stopping the disaster in Iraq is perhaps if other countries were to come in and join us. And to do that, we're going to have a president that's willing to eat a little crow.
I would agree. And I think the president will accept help from any country. Except Iran.
Only on his terms.
Except Iran.
Mike, we only have about a minute left. I just want to briefly raise an issue. And that is the subpoenas that are being directed toward Harriet Myers and to Sarah Taylor. These are both people who worked in the Bush administration on the U.S. prosecutors. Now, we know, we've already had Monica Goodling plead the fifth and say, I'm doing it because I broke criminal law here. I based hiring and firings based on political affiliation, which is a violation of the Hatch Act. Laws were broken, in other words, Monica said, I broke them myself. Doesn't Congress have a right to investigate this, and shouldn't the president respond to their subpoenas by granting them the documents they seek?
Well, Congress can and will investigate anything it wants to investigate. There was a headline, I think it was yesterday, where the number of investigations is now up to 300 since the Democrats took office.
Not enough.
And going further, you know, they haven't passed the budget. They haven't, you know, they haven't enacted anything into law they said they
You're
were going to do.
Changing the topic, Mike.
But we're going into 300 different investigations now. Every president in the history of the country has argued against this personal White House staff being subpoenaed by Congress on executive privilege grounds. The White House is going to do this. They're going to argue executive privilege. It may wind up in court. We'll find out. But no, the White House should not give in.
Our time is up. But look, they issued 1,000 subpoenas to the Clinton administration. Clinton responded to each and every one. And when he asserted executive privilege, he at least gave a log of what documents are missing. George Bush refuses to do even this. And that's why, mark my words, he'll be held in criminal contempt. That's it for the Inside Scoop. This is Mark Levine signing off. Join us next week, Sunday, 6:30 p.m.